Yeah, welcome back, everyone. So this panel brings together almost all presenters. I think it's only two missing who have presented so far in the festival. For a joint discussion, to look at the presentations together, to have the opportunity to also react to each other and to think together, maybe to take up what you said, Kim, how are we able to do better? from the various perspectives that were raised in the discussion so far. And I would like to maybe, for us to start from the kind of maybe utopian vision that also was the basis of your presentation, Kim, and also that we took in the workshop that you also mentioned that some of this group has taken part of, not everybody, which is to start from the point, so what's the world like that we like to see? But then also in this round to think, okay, but what are the concrete steps maybe that we want to take or that we suggest should be taken and by whom? And there was a sentence that you had in your presentation, Femke, yesterday, how we get to the probable and from there to the possible, which I really liked. But maybe first, for those of you who have not seen all presentations, just go through just who we all are. Is Joe Karaganis. I just give your names and just briefly what a key word on what you talked about, and then we can get into the discussion. Joe Karaganis, you talked, one of your focus was on data transparency, correct? If not, then Martin Kretschmer talked about the many levels of platform regulation and effects on culture. Then we had Neva Elkin-Koren, you talked about restoring the public interest in upload filters. Use the name of your presentation. Kimberly Weatherall, we just heard. And Femke Snelting presented yesterday about a feminist perspective on reimagining copyleft. And Rasmus Fleischer presented about various aspects of copyright politics related a lot to Spotify. yeah. So there were lots of things raised in all those presentations, and I was just trying to get together like the main points in the break to see which angles we can get into the discussion. And I maybe suggest, I mean, there's some issues that relate to copyright directly, and there are also others that are on other different levels of regulation. And I suggest, because we've had lots of presentations in the earlier afternoon about platform regulation, that we maybe start with that point and with the issue of that I think most of you raised, this kind of the black box of the platform or of how platforms or media corporations that provide central infrastructures for culture operate, and also how the law enforcement that is on them to some degree, so that they define what is copyright, what is an infringement, what can be uploaded, like all those points that came in your different presentations. And yeah, we've heard different proposals what to do about this. And yeah, I would like to maybe discuss those first. How can we achieve, how can we kind of break up this black box through public oversight, as you said, through true transparency? What would be your like concrete suggestions?
Let me jump into it with something provocative a little bit. And I think that transparency is something that we need to challenge. Martin, you talked about transparency as a form of, you know, that we have that in the German Act of Enforcement, in the Facebook German Act, whatever it's called. And But we know that in these transparency reports, we only get things in the aggregate. So we know, in general, how many things, how much content was removed, or how many requests for removal Facebook or YouTube received. But we don't know what has been removed, right? This is not becoming transparent. And so, to the extent that we expect some oversight from this, it's not going to give us any meaningful sense of what is absent in our public sphere due to that process. And with respect to transparency as a forum that, you know, that Joe discussed, is a form of making platform, using transparency as a form of regulation, right? Let's have them report about the, you know, the revenues, the profits, how they generate income, make things more transparent. I'm also a bit skeptical, just because I think that, you know, we may know that, but if we don't complement it with more competition, then, or, you know, make room for more competition, transparency is not going to be sufficient. So these are my challenges to both of you with respect to transparency.
To add to that, maybe we do know that, you know, filtering is taking place. You know, it's not that filters are going to come. We know they happen now, and if I see any positive things coming out of this change of liability is, you know, that we will find out more how they work. I would agree it's not enough. You know, it's not enough, but it's a starting point and a quite important starting point. And if I add to that, so the paradox really is, you know, copyright is very simple to solve. You know, we all know what the solution would be. It's to have a short exclusive term and then a remuneration right for the lifetime, and the redistribution from the living to the dead is gone, and all the other problems go as well. You know, just wait a few years and then you can do what you like. So structurally, it's quite clear, I mean, what needs to be done, but it won't happen. While on the platform side, you know, we don't know what should happen because it's a kind of it's generally a change to how we organize our societies, and it's really hard to understand. You know, are they utilities or are they you know are they server ships? You know, what are they? It's really a really difficult thing to do. That's my observation.
Do you want to respond, Joe, about the transparency challenge?
Yeah, I mean, it's a bad word in the sense that it gets used in so many different contexts that it, you know, risks becoming meaningless. Mm-hmm. So I'm sensitive to that, and, you know, sometimes I use openness instead of transparency, but that also has a set of, I don't know, a lineage that can be equally problematic. But I you know, the version of this that I'm trying to articulate is one in which opaqueness is a significant barrier to entry for competition, mm-hmm. and that the more you can reveal about the structure of these industries, and you know, who's making how much money out of which step in intermediating relationships between artists and publics, the more likely it is that people will see opportunities to create better or, you know, lower cost or better forms of intermediation. So I do see it as a kind of light competition principle, light pro-competition principle, that, you know, at a minimum clarifies the picture enough to know whether there are more significant antitrust steps to take. So, you know, I think I agree with you we have to be careful about how we use these words, and they have been diluted in a context in which transparency gets used to talk about, you know, every initiative in the industry.
The other thing about transparency is that, you know, in related fields, you know, particularly in the context of, you know, the big discussion that's going on at the moment around regulating AI and algorithms and all of those things, we're actually getting a bit more sophisticated about what transparency means, right? I mean, in some ways, the kind of contesting algorithm idea that you were presenting, Neva, in some ways that's going to provide a certain amount of transparency because you're actually going to be testing what happens. You know, other presentations mentioned there's quite a lot of work being done now in that vein where you don't necessarily see the algorithm. We could probably never see the algorithm because it's too complex. We wouldn't understand it anyway. But you can test what gets taken down, and there's lots of people doing that kind of work. And you may not need more transparency than that, and I think that's the other thing we need to be a bit sophisticated about. You know, transparency doesn't mean you have to see everything. You have to see all the profit and loss statements. You have to see all the distribution, you know, etc. You might just need to know enough about what is getting taken down. I suppose the other point I would make is maybe it's just the not much faith in the market in this context person in me, but that kind of transparency isn't necessarily a step towards competition. It can also be a step towards, no, you can't do that. Like, you know, we see what you're doing, and when it comes to this, we don't like it, stop it.
Neva, you presented this idea of this public AI as a way to get more public oversight into the platform landscape. Maybe we can also look at that perspective. And I'm curious what other speakers' view is on such an idea, or do you have alternatives to the suggested proposal?
Also offer another. You
have your own alternative.
Alternative, yes. No, just to follow up on Kim's point, I think that if the platforms are black box, and maybe they should remain black box. I mean, they probably have to, not because of the complexity only, but also because once we know how they work or whatever algorithm is working, everyone can game the system, right? I mean, so that, and this is something that is not useful for society. And so we need to have to develop ways for understanding that black box. And I agree with you that there are many methods, like challenging, I mean, you've been working on this in, you know, some of your studies, about looking at what is being taken down with parodies, right? What is being targeted and your work on notice and takedown. That these were empirical work that were looking at the platform as a black box. You can feed the platform with things systematically and simply study, document what remains and what is being taken down and how quickly and to what extent. And so I think that we can start to assume that it's non-transparent, that this is a black box, and to tame it as a black box, right? To sort of restrain it in many ways.
I really like the idea of, and I agree with all of that, I really like the idea of the contesting algorithms. You know, I mean, this is a developing method in computer science. It's the sort of, I can't remember, I'm having a mental blank on the terminology, but you know, there's a whole series of studies around this kind of contestation. It does have echoes to me of that, we'll solve the problem with the machine mm-hmm. right? You know, that's something we've been trying to do since at least 1995 or earlier. I can't remember whether it was you or... I know that, it was Dan Burke and Julie Cohen, you know, they sort of will solve fair use with an algorithm that kind of reflects fair use. So it's you know, and I'm sure I haven't read your paper, I look forward to reading it, and I'm sure it's more sophisticated than just this is we'll solve the problem. It's a tool, and it could be a really valuable tool, but it's definitely not ever going to be the only tool.
I mean, looking at the, like, I think it's important to keep the public interest in mind, but at the same time listening to the presentations of this afternoon, you can also see how the attention goes fully to these commercial platforms as a space for distributing and experiencing cultural content. And I think that's a bit scary when I think about these spaces being surveyed both in the interest of capital and in the so-called public interest, which means that they will, let's say there's norming forces on all sides. I think it's super important to remember that cultural practices have technologized. They are entangled with the way technology works. So it means they are also co-defined, co-authored by these systems and infrastructures. So I was interested in Marcus's claim that there cannot be one way of doing creative practice. So I think it's very urgent that there's space made for technological practice that is not going through these commercial platforms. And I think this afternoon even proved it more. I think it's you see how the how and the what get wedged together. And so I think it's important to keep experimenting with other hows and other whats.
Yeah, I can just add a little bit about this thing with gaming the system, because it's obvious, and now we're talking on a very general level, of course, but I mean, it's obvious that any kind of system we're talking about here is gamed to some degree. And it's gamed by those who have a little more insight in the workings of it than others. So, I mean, if transparency makes it possible for everybody to game a system, I mean, that might also be a fair situation. It might be so that the system deserves to be destroyed and replaced by another system. On a very general level.
I mean, I would support, you know, that we need other alternatives. You know, it's possible to do it, and it's our, you know, in a way, choice that they haven't happened. I mean, we have Wikipedia, that there, you know, it's possible to have models, but the trust-based social networks haven't taken off. You know, they haven't taken off, but they could do. It's perfectly possible to have a, you know, a social network which we own. It's and where we set the rules. It's perfectly possible. There's nothing stopping it. And similarly, you know, yes, you know, SoundCloud, you know, we could buy it. It would, you know, it's venture capital owned. If we offer enough money, you know, we probably can take it on. I'm not saying that is a solution, but it's definitely possible. You know, so it's obviously a different approach. The regulatory approach would say, yeah, we have to do something with what we have in front of us. And the other one would be to say we create an alternative reality. And it's possible,
I think,
but hard to predict.
Yeah. I think tomorrow, so this leads maybe to the afternoon, tomorrow we'll hear a bit more from, for example, about the platform cooperative Resonate. I don't know if you're familiar with that project, where that's like try and create a music community around a cooperative model that can serve as a streaming service as well, like those kind of models. I think when you're saying, when you said, Martin, we don't have a utopia for platforms, maybe this is those ideas are something that could be interesting to look into. I mean, unfortunately, we have not heard the presentation yet and cannot really refer to it.
But,
yeah.
But I think that for these ideas to materialize, you really need to keep space for them. I mean, right now, a lot of the challenges that we're facing is that these interactions are happening on private systems, on private servers, right, that belong to someone and that are owned by someone physically. And so I think that, and that is where, I mean, you talked about, you know, the Pirate Bay losing. I think that we have lost the internet, social media, right? I mean, this is sort of I lost my voice.
literally. So I think that we lost the free internet to social media, and I think one of the losses was the idea that every model could actually, you know, be introduced. Right. Right now, if you want to introduce a new app, you need to convince Google or Apple that, you know, that it's appropriate for the App Store. You cannot simply introduce a new way of organizing information or creativity or production. And so I think that is where regulators can actually also step in and force app stores, platforms to introduce the competition.
We did spend a lot of time over the last couple of days talking about a right to be heard for musicians. Maybe we need a right to be hosted, right to be seen, right to be available for technology as well.
Maybe this leads to another point that was mentioned a lot in the presentation so far, which is the power imbalances between different actors, like specifically the musicians and creators having less power and in negotiations with intermediaries and exploiters through facilitated through copyright, and also Femke, you talked about copyright or copyleft not continuing existing power imbalances and structures. And I think also thinking about let's build new services, or let's do it all differently. What is the power actually that we have? What's the space that we have? What's the capital that we have? Like, for those kind of things, maybe we could kind of somehow, speak about this point for a bit. It's an open question too.
So, I mean, it seems to me is this on, right? I mean, the rights of reversion idea is very attractive and seems to me to be in a different category of political possibility than some of the other things we might like shorter terms. I don't think shorter terms is going to happen. I do think it's conceivable to think about much stronger rights reversion that, you know, accords the artist control over that excessive term and does address some of the, and then permits another round of negotiation of how the work is exploited. I think it seems to me to be politically much more imaginable, and would make a huge difference. I mean, I think there's a special case where, there's a great deal of cultural production, especially in Europe, that's funded publicly, and then the public has certain rights that could be reverted as well. So there's a version of this that I've kind of played with on and off over the years. The context was in film production where. Studios just, you know, they go wherever the tax breaks are highest. Film production is located in function of which state has accorded them the greatest, the highest percentage of tax rebates. And so one of the examples of this from a decade or so ago was Warner Brothers saying to the British government, well, you know, your tax rebate is about to expire. You have to, renew the 20% tax break and maybe up it to 30%. Or we'll take Harry Potter production to the Czech Republic. Mm-hmm. And they did. They renewed the break, and Warner Brothers took it to the Czech Republic when the Czech Republic said 30%. And so they, you know, the principle here could be, and I, you know, my name for this was the expecto patronum license, you know, the defense against the dark arts, where you could say, well, for any publicly subsidized work, you grant that period of exclusivity of exploitation for a reasonable period. Let's say in the case of film, it's 5 years or so. That, you know, back when film exhibition windowing was structured differently, that was sort of the end of the road. 5 years was it. And then at the end of 5 years, the artist can decide whether to continue to exercise exclusive rights over the work, in which case they have to pay back the public subsidy. And so there would be a decision about the ongoing commercializability of the work that the artist could exercise some control over. But if they decided not to pay back the subsidy, then the work would have to be released under a kind of Creative Commons or other kind of non-exclusive license. And so, you know, the public would be able to reassert a kind of, you know, their rights in the, you know, in a version of what begins to sound like the investor right, except here the investor is the public. And in certain sectors, European film, for example, the public is overwhelmingly the largest investor. And that could begin, you know, that also seemed to be a way of kind of navigating a more politically palatable and imaginable way to, you know, rebalance some of these rights.
Just a little, because in a way we've seen the same situation in academic publishing, where some, for some like European funded schemes, you're obliged to publish under an open access license. What happened is that the publishers now charge up to 5,000 euros for an open published article. So in a way, it's a win-win-win situation for the publisher and a lose situation for those that create the work. So I wonder how such a license would actually work. I mean, I think it's a very good idea, but we've also seen very cynical flips of such initiatives.
For sure. I mean, in scholarly publishing, I think everything is still up in the air. Or, you know, hard to say what this ecosystem looks like 5 years ago, or 10 years from now. I mean, that publishing model you describe is a worrisome one, but those cost structures are not sustainable either. I mean, there will not be an academic publishing world structured around $5,000 article publication fees. And so that's just not, you know, something else is going to happen. And you know, what it is I think going to be determined in the next 5 years. It's an interesting case.
I think another thing to be aware of is that, you know, I mean, there are countries. In fact, I think Rebecca's recently published or is about to publish a piece that sort of reviews the laws of every single country in the world, whether they have reversion or not. And they've found that more than half the countries in the world have some sort of reversion system. So your right to qualify that by it needs to be strong. You know, it needs to be unwaivable. It can't be something you can contract out of. But it also means, I think, you know, if you're going to make reversion real and do something with it, you also have to have or build or find a way to build alternative things that artists and creatives can then do with the reverted rights. You know, I mean, one option is just to sell it back to another publisher, and that is a good thing because it means at least you get another stab at it, you know, another chance to get some money. But if we want to do it in a public interest kind of way, if we really want to make available the large number, you know, and get some sort of remuneration for the large number of pieces that may not be attractive to commercial publishers, because not every reverted book is or reverted song is going to be attractive to commercial publishers. We need to build alternative systems, alternative distribution systems, maybe Resonate or something like it as the answer to that. But we're going to need, we need more, you know, and as Ruth was pointing out yesterday, you know, we need to think about all those other institutions, not just the ones we have, but the alternatives.
And one addition, I mean, I sympathize with the reversion idea. I think it's within the current, you know, the way the international law is structured, it's the only way you can, in fact, you know, reduce the term in practice. But it works well only for, you know, for books, really. If you've got single authors, then you know, that's something we could arrive at, you know, for games, for films, for, you know, when you have multiple rights, you know, where do the rights revert to? So you have to have then a really complex mechanism. You can do it, you know, you can do it, but the what would be required as a structure to arrive at it would be very, very challenging.
And just to add to that, I think that you've told us about Spotify and the way in which Spotify really look at the music as a nuisance, right? This is like a resource into the real product.
Yeah,
right?
Raw material. Yeah.
Right, and so, but the real product, and that is where the added value of a lot of these platforms is in tailoring content or experience to users, and the real product that they generate is data on the users that are using the content, right? And so if this is a business model, then having more rights, more owners, reverting rights again and having to relicense just create enormous transaction costs that one, you know, so we as users will have to pay for that, right, at one point. And so the question is whether it makes any economic sense in this environment.
Yeah, and also could add that I think, I mean, the general reason that people pay for a service like Spotify, it's not that people lack access to music. It's not that, oh, we need more music in our lives. It's rather the opposite. There are already too much music around to choose between. So you need a service that somehow makes this abundance manageable. So it's actually, as opposed to how the discussion has been moving, I mean, before, I think today it's become more and more clear what's sold is not access to culture, but rather an antidote to overabundance of culture, some kind of management. Yeah, if you understand.
Okay, but if that's right, can we think creatively about other ways to manage overabundance? Mm-hmm. Right. So, another thing that we explored in the workshop was this idea that you could have sort of clubs or guilds or groups of people who are really involved in a particular kind of musical culture we were thinking about. And I'm just wondering whether maybe that's a possibility instead. Like, one of the things that I notice about Spotify when I go on it these days is you sort of look at the front page and it's like, blah, you know, bland, 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 mood music, happy, you know, nondescript music or something. Like, that is not a music experience. That is nothing like what we are having here or at any other music festival I've ever been at. So there must be an alternative that helps manage this abundance. Maybe just gets rid of some of the abundance.
Yeah, exactly. I think these are exactly the right questions to ask. And I also appreciate that you brought up SoundCloud, Martin, because that's an very concrete example that we could also, that we should think more about, because that's, it's not a stable business in any sense. It's been very, very close of financially collapsing several times, and they still are very far from having any kind of sustainable business model. So, what will happen after SoundCloud is kind of a reasonable question, and I can imagine both better and worse situations, so to say. Yeah, better would maybe be in line with your the vision you just were about to move towards. I mean, some kinds of, yeah, I don't know in which words best to put it, but driven by enthusiasm and open for, I mean, various niche cultures to find their own ways of organizing and filtering and selecting stuff.
So it sounds like more money for culture in general.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not sure this works, but yeah, it does. So it seems almost that the diagnosis here is there is we have an oversupply of content, which suggests that maybe the copyright system, you know, is not as ruinous as we think it is. It clearly has event-seeking implication. You know, we know it's a redistribution from the living to the dead, but maybe that's, you know, an effect we could live with. We know, you know, from the artist's resale right, you know, only 18% go to living artists. You know, these are visual works which are resold, and once they're resold at auction, you know, a percentage goes to the right owner. You know, the artist, which is then almost always the estate of the artist. Okay, so that is unproductive money, and copyright. The copyright world is full with that stuff. You know, it's full with essentially, you know, money going to back catalogs and to get going to dead people, and that's a loss to society. But it's probably not worse a loss than we have, you know, in other areas of our capitalist system. So I'm almost inclined, you know, I've been in this kind of world where we try to improve, you know, little bits of copyright law and not make it worse. And you know, we never succeed. You know, you put all the evidence there and it just doesn't happen. It just doesn't happen. And so I almost think, you know, given that we have, you know, pretty much a healthy supply of music, and that there's a this rent-seeking element here. So, you know, can't we think of different ways of doing it? You know, that's, you know, can't we organize ourselves in a way that it delivers what we want, rather than, you know, trying to force, you know, a change in the law. So I'm moving, you know, towards I wouldn't say platform activism, but you know, towards something which is a different policy response to a, you know, to an unsatisfactory but not lethal situation.
So basically moving away from copyright to all the sorts of other laws and regulations, you know, again, as we have been talking about. I mean, you know, just to qualify one point that you were making there, you know, the assertion that, well, there's so much music now, so copyright must be working. I mean, that's a nonsense, isn't it?
You know, there's no,
you know, it's not as bad as it seems. And we know why there's so much music. It's because so many people want to be musicians, right? And we lowered the costs of doing that, and so production went up. And money that people could make from it went down, because there's more of it around.
So, it's interesting how the discussion goes from like this kind of regulating the bigger concepts into like, oh yeah, let's make like create those new ideas, this new services, or also so kind of go from the kind of smaller level activist perspective instead of the kind of bigger picture regulation. I find this an interesting way of the discussion. After you've like commented on each other's presentation, heard each other's presentation, and from the background of your where you are now, if we're coming now up with a kind of a conclusion of what should we do? So what would, like, for each of you, what would be like your priority suggestion? What like after this, what do you say now? I think this is it for me. Because I'm just asking this because I feel we've been going in like so many different directions that I would kind of like to like come to a bit of a more like focus of
Can I disappoint you on that? Just
please.
Briefly?
Yeah, please.
One of the texts I've been thinking about for about 8 or 9 months now is Danny Boyle's Yesterday. Has anybody seen Danny Boyle's Yesterday? Well, it's not a great movie. It's maybe Danny Boyle's 10th greatest film, right? So it's among the craziest copyright texts I've seen in years. And the background to it is this is like $27 million film. He had to spend $10 million clearing the rights to cover a dozen Beatles songs in the movie. And it's about a character, you know, sort of the premise is, you know, this guy wakes up and some supernatural incident has happened and like the Beatles have disappeared from history. And he's the only one who remembers the whole Beatles catalog. So he begins to, you know, reconstruct it from memory and sort of visit all the sort of sacred sites of Beatles song composition. And he becomes, you know, from a kind of bar musician, he becomes this superstar because he's reconstructed the Beatles catalog. And he's then progressively haunted by sort of two things. One is this, you know, there's an old Russian guy who keeps appearing in his shows, and he realizes that this guy remembers the Beatles too. And so he begins to become paranoid about the sort of the disclosure that he's not the author, right? There's this threat of recognition of the collective history of the Beatles that you know, is represented by these figures who keep haunting him. And then at some other point in the movie, he goes and sees, visits John Lennon, who's alive and old, and you know, John just gives him the wisdom of, you know, it's just about the people you love and telling the truth, and you know, this is just, so John Lennon is set up as this kind of the antithesis of the missing figure in all this is Paul McCartney, who's become this kind of copyright reactionary in his old age, and you know, writes letters in support of Article 17 and things like that. So you get this is the John Lennon version of you know, the alternate universe where John becomes the inheritor of the Beatles' legacy. And so he ends up in this kind of spectacular Beatles, you know, cover concert, and decides to just release it all to humanity. You know, his interpretation of the you know, the ways in which he's captured the Beatles' legacy is to just say, oh, this is you know, he's for random supernatural reasons he's become the voice of this collective musical tradition that has to be given back to the world. And it turns out that that's all the old Russian guy wanted anyway. He remembered the Beatles too, and he was sad that they'd been kind of removed from history, and he just wanted it all given back. And so this is kind of one, you know, we've been talking about utopias and dystopias for a few days, and this is a very weird utopian vision of what, you know, the Beatles to Danny Boyle are, and certainly inflected by years of negotiating over rights to cover the songs. But it's, you know, like, it's give it all back, make it all part of the human, you know, it's part of human culture, and you know, that's it's probably, you know, on closer look, and I haven't gone back to look at it, it's probably not a coherent text with a coherent message, right? But it just wraps up many of the things we've been talking about over the days about recognition and the ways in which individual work emerges from collective cultural process, and the ways in which that can be distorted by individual author claims. And I recommend it to you if this conversation, if you want to see a kind of weird pop culture mirror of this conversation, there's a lot of that in Danny Boyle's movie.
I'm surprised he got a license for that.
The ending seems like as big a you know, a middle finger to the, you know, Apple Music and, you know, Paul McCartney, as you could imagine. So I think the very process of licensing got translated into the ending of the movie.
I would still, yeah, like to pass on regarding the priority.
Yeah, I think I would commit to two extremes. The one is really just rule of law, you know, have due process and transparency wherever possible. We need that more than ever, I think, in the way the world is going. So I think this very, very small stuff, but precise, and it has to be tested, you know, with each of the new initiatives, because we have, you know, we're in this wave of, you know, online harm and regulatory explosion worldwide, and it could go terribly wrong. So that's on one end. On the other, I think we just have to try different models. I think it has to come that way. It's not by changing copyright law, it's by our behavior and how we, you know, do music.
Yeah, so I think in terms of our strategy, we need to be more innovative as lawyers in the way we approach this and not think about the standard regulation of, like, let's create a new agency, let's create new rules that we cannot really enforce against these giants, and that would make us dependent upon their self-report and self-assessment. I think that in terms of the goals of this effort of the public to reinstate itself in this environment where private parties are actually shaping our public sphere, we need to get a right of access, like, you know, for innovation and new models, and that could actually be part of just, you know, old-fashioned regulation. This is net neutrality type of regulation, you know, that platforms should be forced to actually enable new types of apps and systems that enable new ways of sharing and producing. And I think the other goal for this type of public intervention should have to do with the data. I think this is a data. I mean, the name of the game is not platform, it's a data economy. And I think that we're just starting to see what it's like. We're talking about content moderation, but we haven't started to talk about the physical space. This is going to be the same problem in smart cities, in autonomous cars, in Internet of Things. It's private platforms that are going to own all these spaces. And it's all about the way in which, you know, who controls the processing of data. And I think that is where we should focus our efforts.
These are all good ideas. I mean, I 100% agree with what you've just said. It's all about the data. But it's all about, to go back to your first point, Neva, it's actually about lawyers thinking more creatively about precisely that question too. One of the difficulties we have with all of surveillance capitalism, in a sense, is this idea that, you know, that we see all of this through individual privacy type lens, when really this is a much bigger societal question and it's a more collective question. You know, I was talking with someone online the other day, you know, and you know, that question of, well, it's, you know, the GDPR model, it's all just about, you know, telling people what you're doing with their data and giving individuals chances to sort of opt in or opt out, or we'll just make those stronger. That's not going to solve things. Because that's a much bigger thing that we could solve by focusing on data, not just copyright. But we need to be thinking about data collectively. We need to be thinking about society's interests in data. We need to be thinking about communities' interests in data and how we can assert all of that. And, you know, to come back to the musician and, you know, this festival as opposed to the big problems of the world, I think we need to think collectively about music too, right? We need to think collectively about what our interests as creatives or musicians are, and we need to start having those conversations and asserting those collective interests. As I said, you know, at the end of my talk, the rules are not being made by musicians. The rules haven't been made by musicians just about ever, as Ruth pointed out yesterday. It would be nice if at least some of the rules started being made by musicians that influence their lives. But that's never going to happen unless we start shouting louder.
Or more smartly, or something. More collectively.
Yes, what to do. I think it's important to not forget that these platforms are, let's say, dispossession machines, where the optimization is not in the interest of more culture, but in the interest of capital. And that means that you can try to limit their damage, but it's not where the culture is going to be made. So I think it's important to not lose too much time in trying to mend them, because I think our attention is very, very necessary for other spaces. Because this is not the spaces where more lives are going to be possible, where the spaces of possibility are going to be extended. It's the opposite. This is where the probable is at work. And I think I'm interested in spaces that do something else. And I think we need all the energy we have to support, fund, enjoy those spaces.
I totally agree. Thank you. And I mean, can't add very much now, but yeah, I mean, relating to the need for experimentation, I would also say that, I mean, experimentation is not something that might happen in the future. I mean, we should look for the experimentation that is already happening. And different kinds of musical cultures already have different approaches to authorship or pseudo-authorship and so on. I mean, if you go to dance music cultures, I mean, it's not that a problem that a DJ is copying another DJ's set list. I mean, because there's norms, there are ideals. I mean, there are sometimes stuff is sold without recourse to formalized copyright. And I'm not saying that because there is models to be universalized, but But the experimentation is ongoing, and of course not only in the global north, but all over the world.
Yeah, I think this is a very, I'm lacking the word, but inspiring, yeah. Round of ideas. I have one organizational question to Lena, because with the time change, I'm kind of confused at what time we have to end. Because we started later, do we have to stop now or no?
15 minutes, yeah.
Okay, great. That's perfect. Then we have some time also for if you have any questions in the audience.
Hello. I have a question regarding, I feel that copyright is understood as if it's like a legit thing by default, like if it has some legitimacy, like private property. And I mean, my question is that now that all this kind of system of accumulation and super extreme inequality and obviously, you know, domination of resources by only certain countries and powers and regions. For a lot of people, I feel, or at least where I hang out, it is not legit, the system of property. Like, private property has no legitimacy. And even in relation to culture and that, like, I mean, the question is a lot of, like, the trouble of how you can, you know, support with the livelihood of like people and stuff, but without supporting like a system that it's unfair, which is based on these private property laws. So I just, my question is a little bit of like how you want, what's which possibilities are really in like optimizing like a legal system within like a system that it's not fair at all? Like, it's not working, innovation, competition, all these words kind of like make me super nervous. Like, I want to hear more about nationalization and, you know, paying taxes from like these companies. Like, really, is like a lot of the conversation, it is about how we don't normalize these black boxes. I don't care if it's transparent or if it's a black box. We don't want this kind of competition system, a lot of people. So I don't know if you have some thoughts about, like, I didn't hear the word commons, like, a lot, for instance. So it just makes me a little bit nervous that the conversation of copyright is still stuck in, like, that private property is legit somehow.
Yeah, I think that there's some copyright that's completely legitimate for artists, and it's great to sell one's work. Also, if one has one's own copyright, it's amazing. I mean, it's one of the best feelings. So, you know, ownership of work and putting out into the world and actually being paid for it is really great. If it's being shown in a blockbuster film and they maybe have, like, you know, 5 minutes of your song then there, and, you know, when it's talking about the kind of like fiscal dimensions that are, it's amazing. I mean, I think it should just be much more popcorn maybe, and just, you know, maybe like the choice of music in these blockbuster films should maybe also be like a broader spectrum. That's maybe what we're missing, like just more money for everyone and not so narrowed.
The interesting thing about those two comments is that I don't think they're inconsistent at all, even though they sound like they're arguing with each other. Because, the kinds of goals that copyright is trying to achieve, and in some cases does achieve, are completely legitimate. You know, there's a lot of good reasons why at least some proportion of creators really want to assert their interests in their music and make money from it, and that is fine. The reality, though, is that there are a whole bunch of ways that the copyright system and copyright rights don't work very well that we could try to fix.
Okay, so what is it that, if we're talking about the recorded music business, I mean, what is it that the rights, to what uses do the money go? I mean, in the past century or so, as I mentioned in my talk, I mean, phonographic rights were installed because it was expensive to record music, it was expensive to distribute music, and so on. It is not anymore. But today it's very expensive to market music. So it's very much, you need money for two things. You need it to buy time. You need time to make any kind of art. That's like the basic point here we're talking about. It's not money, but it's time. But then comes all the other costs, which are not so much equipment or distribution costs, but marketing costs. So, I mean, of course, these matters are related. I mean, how to free time for artistic production, and how to somehow make it possible that it reaches out to people and does not get stuck in a competitive circus where you have to pay more and more of the income just to market your own work.
Maybe, Femke, as your approach was copyleft and not copyright, do you want to make a comment on this? I just felt that maybe because you did not take it as a default copyright.
Yeah, I think it's important that, what we see happening now is that the individualized property-based idea of authorship, because I'm not so much, I try not to talk too much about copyright because I'm interested in author practice. I think, again, like this is where I would like to support and put my energy, is not just that. So there is many of different kinds of doing author practice. And I think it's very easy to overlook these kinds of practices. And we saw in the last presentations that they actually effectively get crushed in the way copyright is being applied in platforms, and I think that is a waste.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering. Hello. Yeah, I was wanting to expand on what Femke started to say about supporting local culture and the spaces where real things are being pioneered and people are living the culture and making and. It's making me think from this panel and today's talks that the real problems arise from these people who are trying to solve problems for this mass scale industry. And it's not the mass scale industry that we really need to try to solve their problems. Unfortunately, I don't think we'll be able to annihilate the whole industry and how it works, but what we could possibly do is I don't know, some taxing it in some way that something comes back from that huge industry into supporting these local community centers, these local venues, the people who are emerging artists who are looking for resources to make their albums or something like this. And it's also reminding me like the time when I really fell in love with going out and seeing bands and supporting music was when I went to these places and you're paying directly to support people that you can have an actual relationship with. You know, you see a band play in a small venue, you buy their stuff at that venue. Last night I went to West Germany after here, and it was like a brilliant underground scene of 8 or 9 different people performing music. They all had their stuff for sale on the table, and I felt good about giving money to that, but I don't feel good about giving my money to online platforms that I know that money is not going to the artist. So I feel like I'm going to speak badly about the internet again because I think the culture has created something so odious that it has exploded something where we want to reach and consume more from these things far away, but where you really get the juices of the stuff flowing is when you get into the local culture and you get to interact with the people who are producing the stuff. So it's not a question, sorry. But.
Does anyone want to comment on?
Just one thing, just to insist that I'm not trying to put, let's say, local against networked. I think there's super interesting networked experiments going on, and I think they need support too.
Yeah, and I think much of this experience also takes place on a platform like Bandcamp, which can be very much about kind of direct contact with local scenes all over the world. So that's also a platform, but it's not the ones we're talking about here so much.
Okay, can I shoot? Now, I have a question regarding when you talk about sound design and how copyright is not covering timbre and rhythm, and that's somehow the way a big part of content is going towards. So if we talk about timbre and, for example, how music is being created through programming, and so do you think copyright will move towards protecting content or protecting data?
How do you mean, content or data?
Let's say we as musicians, I'm a musician, not against anyone, we record something on a guitar and it goes to a record, and then copyright is protecting this record. But then if we think about timbre, which is not so easy to put into a melody or something that can actually be protected, it's going to be recognized as an AI system in ones and zeros. That means data. Mm. So it would be protecting data or protecting content, or how would these platforms in the future kind of work? I'm trying to figure it out in my head, but how would the future look if we're talking about content or data? Because at the end, it's going to be recognized by a program to know where the money has to go.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I don't know how the future will look, but it's one thing that we have phonographic rights in specific recordings, but except for that, yeah, I think it's interesting because, I mean, also if we think historically, copyright, musical copyright was established in, let's say, the long 19th century, which was an extraordinary time in musical history because it's a time when lots of stuff happened in terms of how do you play notes on a score, but nothing happened in terms of technology, in terms of how you produce the sounds. It was the same instruments and very little innovation on that front. So that was a time when one kind of innovation stopped and other kinds thrived. And of course, that situation is changing. Sorry?
The phonograph was invented in the 19th century. The record player, gramophones.
19th century.
Yeah, the phonograph itself.
Okay, in the late 19th. Okay, but there were no record industry. Now I'm talking about the symphony orchestra, the instruments, and so on. I mean, yeah, but it's like the same instrument and the same acoustic ideal. That's true. Yeah. Of course, but I mean, it happened relatively little compared to before and after, I would say. Oh yeah. I mean, it's all massively fascinating. Telamonium, of course. I mean, but I mean, you're also talking about like very emergent stages of technology in the late 19th century. I was generalizing the background from which musical copyright was built, and musical copyright obviously was constructed with the telharmonium in mind, but rather the symphonic orchestra and the piano. So okay, sorry, but. Where was I? Yeah, but good point. Anyway, I think there's always been lots of musical innovations that have not been captured in the grid of private property, but has gone at other paths. Just like lots of innovation in terms of timbre and rhythm has not been captured in copyright, but they have still happened somehow.
Okay, I just wanted to get back to the question that maybe about the data, about the song or the metadata. And the thing is like that for the online, on the a piece online, it's then the metadata is made of it. And it's just this like compression. And that just represents the song, but of course they're connected. So you have these two pieces of information. You have like the actual music piece, and then you have your metadata. But it's, you can't really separate it. Because it's like the, for the ID, for the recognition, for the audio ID, you can't have the actual audio track to find it because it's too much information to have a library of millions of these songs. So that's why you compress it into this thing that sounds like white noise, but it's basically a structure. So I don't know, but they're together. You can't separate them.
Can I make a suggestion?
Yeah.
Really don't try too hard. And the reason I'm saying that is because I teach copyright. I have taught copyright for 20 years. And the more you go down this rabbit hole of exactly what is the work, and is it this technical version or that technical version or the other technical version, the more confused you do end up making yourself. And it's really not the important question in a lot of ways. You know, the important questions are a lot of the other things that we're talking about tonight, like power structures, like money flows, like who gets to control what. You know, in a sense, it doesn't matter much if it's the metadata or the more informed version that the rights are in, if the same person holds both. So, like, sometimes that sort of thing, those sorts of things matter, but a lot of the time they don't. I mean, if you think... We had this case that went to the High Court recently in Australia, and they were trying to work out what precisely was the copyright-protected piece of software. And it was some sort of massive, you know, millions of lines of code, customer relationship manager thing, and it had been through hundreds and hundreds of versions. And they tried to get down to this really technical question of exactly which version... On what date, at what hour, was the thing that might have been infringed, and did they have a license for precisely that version? And the High Court turned around pretty much and just went, oh, get real. Because if we're going to have to do that, we can't make sense of this system at all. So just when it comes to that sort of... I will freely admit, particularly since I'm sitting next to other legal academics, that sometimes it matters. But a lot of the time it doesn't. And a lot of the time, there's a lot more important questions that we need to think about, like supporting music culture.
I think this is kind of a good wrap-up, or a good note to wrap up. Is there, from any one of you, like any thought that's still on your mind that you still want to share? Because we think we need to, with a view on time, need to wrap up. No? Okay. Good. Well, thank you very much. I would say if you enjoyed how this discussion kind of ended, or the round of priorities, you should definitely come back tomorrow, because tomorrow will be a lot about experiments, different forms of governance of systems, cooperatives, collaborative approaches, and so on. So, exactly those experiments that you were kind of calling for. So hope to see you tomorrow. Thank you.